Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
Breaker, breaker, 1-9. I'm in outer space with a microphone.
That's the object of symbols, is to manipulate consciousness. That's why you have symbols, because symbols tell you something, you know, and they speak to you. But know those symbols mean something, and if you understand the culture that developed those symbols, they're telling you something. They're also manipulating you, because now you've read it, now you understand what it's saying, now you abide by what it's saying, so it's manipulating you. Be at least to be aware that propaganda comes in all forms, you know, verbal, motion pictures, television, newspapers, magazines. But propaganda does not deceive you. It helps you to deceive yourself. So you need to educate yourself as to how symbols are used, who's doing this. And it's not necessarily bad in all cases, of course. I mean, you advertise products, you advertise the reason why that product is better than the other. It's not, it's a propaganda, but it's at least it's explaining something to you. The point I want to make is that you need to understand that there are very powerful organizations in this world that have lots of money, and they have an agenda. And so they will put their propaganda, they pay large sums of money to professional people that know how to manipulate you. They know what you want to hear. Symbols are very important, and words and terms. Words are really important.
Because words are symbols of sound.
Of course. Words actually are very, very important stuff.
The people in control that want to control consciousness,
they keep reinforcing the misunderstanding. They keep reinforcing it by their continual television shows and harping on certain understandings. So, you know, like Hitler said, you just keep telling a big lie, and eventually everybody's going to believe it.
So how do we break that down and free people to...
Education. Very simple.
The stuff you're saying?
Well, and it's not like I'm coming up with something vastly different that no one's ever heard. No, it's in a library. Go to the library and pick up a book on the origins of Christianity, the origins of religion, the origins of America. It's all there. I mean, wisdom and knowledge is everywhere if you just want to take the time to look.
Some old cardinals had give someone information that, you know, as a child, and they'll believe it the rest of their life.
That's what the Jesuits said.
Yes.
Give me a child to a seven, and he'll be mine forever.
That's right.
That's true. That's the problem with religion, government. It's everywhere. All institutions are infected with this problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, even education, universities and colleges, they have a code of knowledge, and you cannot step outside of that box. And, your mind is like a parachute. Doesn't work if it's not open.
Right.
Once you begin to open your mind and start studying and reading and getting the background on symbols and terms and words, you begin to understand that we've been manipulated from birth. We need to back up and go all the way back to day one and start re-educating yourself the way the world really works.
So as our nation's children continue to get dumber and dumber by the day, I have an idea that I think might help a little, and I know it's insane, but give it a second. What if we taught kids American history that actually happened? I know it's crazy, but enough of this bullshit, like, oh, the settlers met the natives and they shared squash and it was delicious. When kids grow up being lied to, they grow up to become douchetards. It's a proven fact. Let's tell them the truth that the settlers slaughtered the natives because the settlers had guns and Satan on their side and the natives had dream catchers, all right? It's not easy to win a war when you're trying to stab someone with a peace pipe. Let's tell the kids the truth for once, that the forefathers had slaves and Texas was stolen and Columbus didn't discover jack shit and your mom's not really in Canada. She's in Cleveland banging the guy who used to mow our lawn. Let's tell kids the truth, because bullshit does not make for a good foundation for a worldview, all right? If you ever stood on a pile of shit, it's very slippery. It's very slippery. And here's something else. That dirty, unsettling history of America, at least it's interesting. The kids would be riveted for the first time ever. They'd be sitting in history class with eyes the size of dinner plates, just like, whoa, 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 whoa. Jefferson was fucking who? And Woodrow Wilson was a white supremacist, and Abraham Lincoln was a manic depressant, and Jefferson was fucking who? They would be sneaking outside of class, hiding under the bleachers, reading the steamy details of Ben Franklin banging a slew of French inventor groupies in his stagecoach after the Renaissance Man show. And then these kids would think they could achieve something. They'd be like, hey, I'm f***ed in the head. My heroes were f***ed in the head. Maybe I can do something great. Maybe I can land somewhere with 20 million inhabitants and say I discovered it. I'm Lee Camp, and that's your moment of clarity. Get more of these at leecamp.net.
There is a peaceful solution called Peace Revolution. Now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in. I know we can win it. So let's take back America. There was a dream, so believe it and get ready to receive it. Now let's take back America.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast in higher education. Thank you for making time in your busy schedule to tune in and grow in the light direction. Peace Revolution and all the educational media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented as a public service without corporate sponsorship and is published commercial-free and free to the public thanks to the generosity of the subscribers of the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media hosts featured at TragedyandHope.com. I encourage you to check the episode notes, references, and links for this and all other episodes we publish at PeaceRevolution.org. I also invite you to click on the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community, wherein over 1,000 critical thinkers from around the world are engaging in a fear-free zone of mutual respect, individually sharpening our intellectual self-defense skills and practicing the universal arts of liberation. If you experienced the phenomenon of laughter in the introduction of this episode, it wasn't likely Jordan Maxwell's voice that you were laughing at, but rather that of New York comedian Lee Camp, who has graciously given me permission to feature his rants occasionally, as I find that his sense of humor and content of his rants and his shared observations are in many ways in sync with the ideas presented throughout the Peace Revolution podcast. You can find more of Lee's work at leecamp.net. Now, on another point of exciting news, we recently approached John Taylor Gatto to do a comprehensive interview session to memorialize his life's work, and he accepted. He's flying here to Hartford from July 1st through July 3rd, and from this multi-day interview session, we're going to produce a DVD series titled A Day with John Taylor Gatto, which we can distribute to students, parents, teachers, administrators, and politicians, not just in the United States, but around the world. We've also had generous offers to translate A Day with John Taylor Gatto into various languages. So if that's something you're interested in, please email me at richard@tragedyandhope.com. Now, this is all likely news to you if you're not participating already in the Tragedy and Hope online community, as therein we've already been working for the past week formulating questions and raising the funds needed to make the most out of this rare opportunity. You see, Lisa and I experienced something this past week which not only humbled us, but also greatly encouraged and inspired us. And I thought it might be beneficial to share it with you. And it starts like this. On May 23rd, 2011, I sent a package to Gatto with an interview request containing some of the DVDs we've produced in the past. And my plan was to drive to his farm in Oxford, New York and interview him. Thus, my proposed budget for this project only included gas money and tolls, which I thought would be realistic to get together and get it done. However, we didn't immediately receive a response from Gatto, and remembering what I had learned from him, and specifically how he teaches his students how to access anyone in the world and to offer quid pro quo to get what you're looking for. So I had done this, and I didn't give up, and I thought, how else could I get in touch with him? How else could I make the connection with him? I'd followed the steps. I just needed to get the letter actually in front of him, and then the steps could proceed forward. I then recalled that Melissa Simeone, a member of the Tragedy and Hope online community, had filmed Gatto in Minnesota back in February. The footage of this is on Jan Ervin's Gnostic Media YouTube page under the title Death by Pedagogy, and it's linked in the episode notes. So I contacted Melissa, and I forwarded my interview request to her, and she passed it on through her connections, and eventually, it was both faxed and snail-mailed to Gatto's farm. About a week later, I then received a phone call from a fire chief in New Mexico who has introduced Gatto's work to the local school board and administrators and is flying Gatto to Carlsbad in September. He indicated that he had just spoken with Gatto, who indicated that he had received my letter, watched the DVDs, and invited me to telephone him to set up the interview. At this point, I had no idea what was going to unfold, so I was naively excited, thinking that it was well within my resources to confirm this interview, being that it would only cost gas, money, and tolls. After several calls to his farm and being instructed to call back the next day, I finally spoke to Gatto this past Saturday, and he indicated he'd call me back on Monday evening to confirm the interview. During that conversation, he indicated that he would like to come here to Hartford to do the interview, and that he'd very much like to check out our project and enjoy our hospitality, to which I graciously, albeit naively, agreed. I still thought this was very much a win-win because for the same cost of gas and tolls, we would have the world's most famous educator here, where I could take much more time and care in setting up the cameras, lights, and microphones. On Monday the 20th, I sat by the phone all evening like I was waiting for a call from a potential employer. And having been through that experience before, I wasn't the least bit surprised or disappointed that I didn't receive a call that evening. It came the next morning around 10 a.m. "This is John Gatto," he said, and he indicated that he was excited about coming to Hartford. "Great," I thought, as this is an unimagined opportunity to memorialize his work and to get the word out to the world. We agree that the interview will take place on July 2nd and 3rd, and I realized I just agreed to paying for a hotel room for two nights, which I didn't budget for. "Just agree to it," I thought, "and I'll figure out how to pay for it later. We've got over a week to raise the money." Then he says, "Just one other thing." And I thought, well, I'm sure it's doable. He says, "I need to fly to Hartford. I'll need you to cover the ticket. Do you have a budget for this project?" And I said, "Well, that's completely reasonable, as it saves you a long drive, and I don't want you to have to pay out of your own pocket to do this, so I'll call you back in a few minutes to confirm." And I hung up the telephone, and Lisa and I discussed how we don't have the money to do this. And I said, "Well, if we don't confirm, we'll never have the money to do this, so let's just confirm and have the faith that, like the rest of the steps which got us this far, we'll learn our way forward." So I called back and confirmed with John and set about figuring out how to raise the money to produce this multi-day interview and pending DVD set. This is where we were completely humbled, as only a few hours after adding this little chip-in widget to the Tragedy and Hope community, we raised enough money to pay for Gatto's airfare, hotel, food, tolls, and gasoline. In fact, we raised over the initial goal, which is good because I underestimated the cost. And thus far, we've taken a prolific step forward together. So I want to thank those few who took the time to consider the importance of this project, who read my request, and who contributed to making it a success. In exchange, or in the spirit of quid pro quo, those who donate $50 or more to the cost of producing A Day with John Taylor Gatto will receive a copy of the multi-DVD set inclusive of the entire interview. So if you haven't yet contributed, you can still do so, as there's a whole list of other costs associated with the post-production of this project, which will involve the printing of the DVDs, etc., for public distribution. We also have an 8-person crew to feed over the 2 days of filming, so I hope to provide gas money for folks like Kevin Cole or Tony Myers and Rick Malko, who are all traveling in from out of state to help operate cameras and other equipment while I'm conducting the interview. So if any of this interests you and you'd like to see some more educational, commercial, free media come out of Tragedy and Hope, there's a link in the episode notes on peacerevolution.org, or you can use the donate button on the side of tragedyandhope.com or the Tragedy and Hope community, and your contribution will likewise be greatly appreciated. The point is that with a little energy on my part to list an event announcing the Gatto Project and formulating a request to the community, Lisa and I went from feeling hopeless in the face of opportunity to feeling humbled in the face of our community. And to those of you who responded, your generosity proves that you don't have to be a billionaire in order to create meaningful change in a world that can affect hundreds of thousands of people. And together, with all who chipped in, we are doing what seemed a few days ago to be impossible, proving that each and every step in the journey is equally important. To that end, today's episode is composed so as to give you a paradigm-lifting and perspective-expanding view into how the world really works. And I'll be referring you to two fascinating discussions which will help to comprehensively present both microcosmic and macrocosmic illustrations, helping to ensure you understand the overall big picture, as well as specifically understanding how it applies to each and every one of us, until we learn our way out of it. First, let me present a few definitions so that we can all be on the same page and thereby get the most out of this adventure. The concept of anarchy, or anarchism, was developed by William Godwin, who coined the phrase survival of the fittest, and who was considered to be the first modern proponent of anarchism as well as an exponent of utilitarianism. And like most other isms, anarchism is an individual social management system, amounting not to learning how to discern fact from fiction for oneself, nor does it mean learning how to be self-reliant, nor does it instill a methodology of critical thinking, nor does it help to remove contradictions to discern what exists or that which does not exist. Rather, anarchy is merely a vacuum of power, a governmentless region. It does not automatically bring about utopia. In fact, without a methodology of critical thinking and non-contradictory identification via logic, it creates chaos from which the elite can readily reestablish their power structure, remaking their form of order from chaos. The next definition is that of autonomy, which is the ability to discern fact from fiction, to be self-reliant, and depends upon a methodology of critical thinking and creative problem-solving. It is a constant state of learning. It is open-source education, and it is the improving of our perspectives or models of reality to that which exists, dismissing the arbitrary and that which does not exist. The next definition is that of Amtssprache, which is a German word which literally means official language, but in this specific context, it first appeared in the United States vernacular post-World War II and the Nuremberg trials, wherein Adolf Eichmann blithely elaborated upon how the German people could be turned into what U.S. audiences had viewed as a monster. Eichmann said that it was the words, the actual language, and specifically the format and tone of the words which were being used to direct the masses to murder. Amtssprache provably was the very culprit of such homicidal urges on the part of everyday people who were enlisted into the National Socialist or Nazi ideology. Outsourcing one's thinking to others is how the elite aristocratic establishment has undermined civilization after civilization over thousands of years. More recently, in the 1960s, Dr. Stanley Milgram ran his famous experiments showing that a large majority of the general population of the world, though seemingly docile, were capable of murder if directed by an authority, using words in such a way that it denies the individual choice, using stimulus and response techniques, and overriding their critical thinking. In 1971, Dr. Philip Zimbardo ran the infamous Stanford University prison experiment wherein he used words to dehumanize the prisoners and encourage the guards to outsource their thinking, personal responsibility, and sense of cause and effect to the authority figure in the form of the prison warden, who was in fact Zimbardo himself. The point is this, the Amtssprache fallacy. It's my terminology for the fallacy, or error in thinking, which is represented when an individual believes that someone else can be responsible for their actions, or that their actions are exempted from the laws of cause and effect. The Amtssprache fallacy is possibly the most viciously used form of rhetoric, or the use of words, to deceive individuals as well as the general public. Moreover, it is the single most cause of anger, aggression, violence, genocide, and war in our world today. Amtssprache has existed for thousands of years. The Germans didn't invent it. They just came up with a really clever way to immortalize it in the form of a word. The last definition is meme. A meme, M-E-M-E, is a mind virus, something which takes on a life of its own and in the process feeds off of yours in order to do so. A meme is an idea, behavior, or style that spreads from person to person within a culture. While genes transmit biological information, memes are said to transmit ideas and belief information. A meme acts as a unit for carrying cultural ideas, symbols, or practices which can be transmitted from one mind to another through writing, speech, gestures, rituals, or other imitable phenomena. Supporters of the concept regard memes as cultural analogs to genes in that they self-replicate, mutate, and respond to selective pressures. Memes can become extinct when there are no longer minds willing to give them entry. To this end, I'll be leveraging a recent discussion given by Larkin Rose, an extract from his recent interview on the Gnostic Media podcast with Jan Ervin, also linked in the episode notes. After Larkin exposes you to two perspectives via his brilliantly juxtaposed dialogues, I'll be playing a rare interview with the elusive Professor Carol Quigley, author of Tragedy and Hope, published in 1966. As this 1974 interview begins, we can hear Quigley mentioning the enormous number of Prussian PhDs who have assumed a level of control, as well as Quigley's request for his recording to be held discreetly so he can preserve his job. If Quigley was a supporter of the Jesuits or the Vatican, his comments regarding the Spanish-American War indicate otherwise. If Quigley was an elite, then why would his publisher and its owners continuously have to lie to him about his book being out of print when the fact was that the plates had been destroyed? Quigley can be heard denouncing J.P. Morgan and points rather to All Souls College, Oxford, home of the Round Table Group created by Cecil Rhodes and the De Beers Cartel, which in fact is owned by the Rothschild banking empire. Quigley therein illustrates how this Round Table Group leveraged South Africa, specifically Rhodesia, named after Cecil Rhodes. Quigley's work is the highest quality academic work of nonfiction which represents a comprehensive picture of how the world really worked in the 20th century, and from it we can infer our own present and thereby improve our chances at satisfaction in our future. But only if we learn from our history so it no longer repeats. If you take the time to listen and focus your attention, you will learn some of the most prolific secrets of human history. If we ignore this history of how we as a human species have been enslaved by words, we will be doomed to folly. And I say, let's not give these pricks the satisfaction. Literacy is only a form of slavery until critical thinking is exercised by the reader. This is episode 34, How the World Really Works, Cause and Effect versus Our Beliefs. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
So it's weird what people will accept because they were brought up in it, but if you give them the exact same thing that they weren't brought up in, suddenly it doesn't at all sound like something they want or believe in or would be at all comfortable with. And it just sort of shows how most people don't think about things to get to where they are. They didn't figure out reality to come to their belief system. They just inherited it from somebody else who just smacked it into their heads while they were growing up. And they don't really understand. They don't know it's true, and they don't understand it, and they can't even explain why they think it when you get down to the details. And it's certainly not...
Isn't that typical for most people with their beliefs or whatever it may be?
Yeah, and not even just beliefs about religion, but certainly beliefs about politics, which is my main focus and has been for years now, that what people believe about government and law and authority is a completely irrational mythology.
That brings us kind of forward to the reason that I really wanted to have you on the show. At the Free Your Mind conference in Philadelphia, where you and I met and where I was also presenting, you gave a presentation basically, to put it succinctly, on the validity of the government itself. And you did this in a dialectic form that myself and several other people found fascinating. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what gave you the idea to do this style of presentation, and just what was the thinking behind that? And then what I want to do is I do want to allow the audience to actually hear your entire presentation from the Philly lecture. It was about 39 minutes. And then we'll come back to you after that as well.
Sure. Yeah. I've given lots of talks about basically anti-political philosophy, on the fact that government and law and authority and a lot of things that everyone take for granted and really model their lives around obedience to a ruling class, even though they don't like calling it that anymore. That it doesn't make any sense. It's utterly irrational. It contradicts everyone's moral code. It contradicts logic all over the place. It's basically a completely nonsensical, self-contradictory cult belief. Trouble is, if 6 billion people have it, it doesn't feel weird. If everyone shares the same completely bogus, unreasonable belief, then it feels comfortable and it feels normal. And so I've given lots of talks about the topic from every angle and, you know, every way I can think of. And basically the talk occurred to me as if you're brought up in a belief system and everybody around you believes it and accepts it, this is whether it's religious or political or scientific or whatever it is. If everyone around you believes something, you never have to really question it. You never have to examine it. You sort of just repeat it because everybody else does. And so I sort of thought of how funny it would be to try to explain what people believe about authority and law and government to somebody who didn't believe it. And on this planet, there aren't very many people. And even the ones who don't believe it, they at least know, you know, they usually came from that belief. They used to be statists. They used to believe in government. And so I thought, wouldn't it be funny if somebody from another planet came down who didn't, they don't have a ruling class, they don't have these hallucinations of authority where they think some of them have the right to forcibly dominate all the others and all the others have some obligation to obey. And basically, so this alien comes down and asks an earthling to explain to him, well, what is this government thing you keep talking about? Can I see it? Will you show me it? And so the talk was basically, I was basically thinking, how can I make this a little bit new and interesting and hopefully a little funny in places? And so the setting was basically trying to get an alien, or getting an alien to try to have an earthling explain to him what this government thing is. Like, point to it. Let me see it. How does it work? And explain some things. And so the talk was mostly just the back and forth between this, you know, normal average earthling trying to explain to alien visitor what this government thing is and how it works, this law and authority and law enforcement and legislation and all that stuff. And of course it crashes and explodes, because when you start from scratch and try to explain it in a way to try to make it make sense, it just doesn't. It can't be done. And luckily for most people, they're never asked to do that. But my little talk was basically, here's what would happen if they were asked to try to rationalize what almost everybody believes about government.
And your presentation from Philly was compared by a few different people to things like Gulliver's Travels, Plato's Republic, as well as Galileo's Dialogue. And so, you know, it's really nice to see somebody actually putting the dialectic to use like this and showing the full argument in, you know, you did it on stage right there in front of everybody. So basically we're going to cut away to that right now. And so we'll be playing your lecture there for the next 39 minutes, and then we'll come back to you.
All right.
My topic today is mind control, but a different kind of mind control than you might usually think of. To me, the concept of mind control brings up the image of somebody strapped to a chair with electrodes on his head and being tortured and drugged and things like that, which is very real, and I'm sure that is a very effective way to do mind control on one person at a time. But if you want to do mind control on 100 million or 300 million people, it's going to take a while to do it that way. There is another method of mind control that is done right out in the open. It's done right in front of us, and it's not usually viewed as mind control. The way to do popular mind control, to do mind control on an entire community or an entire society, is to tell a lie to everybody all at once and keep telling them that lie over and over again until they actually perpetuate the lie themselves. If you were a control freak and you wanted to rule the world and you had to go door to door one person at a time and try to convince one person at a time that he should throw away his self-ownership and his self-determination and blindly obey you instead, you would not be a very successful tyrant. But if you can spread a lie to everybody at once, to the point where they don't see the lie, and to the point where they repeat the lie themselves, then you're in business. Then you have a long career as a megalomaniac ahead of you. Now, I know there are a lot of talks about conspiracy up here, and I know a lot of Americans have sort of a gut reaction of, oh, you think it's a government conspiracy, as if that's preposterous. Frankly, I think that's a really weird attitude. My wife and I ran a little medical transcription business. We conspired. We spent a lot of time thinking and planning how to make this business, how to make it run smoothly, how to make it so we could make money off of it. The idea that the people who like power wouldn't, behind closed doors, try to figure out how to do what they do, wouldn't conspire, is idiotic. Everyone conspires. If I was a control freak and didn't care about the self-ownership of everybody else, I would conspire, find ways to trick them and lie to them and deceive them and enslave them to my will. As it happens, I think people own themselves, so I don't play that game. But I want to talk about a type of mind control that starts with a conspiracy, but the conspiracy becomes irrelevant and unnecessary. And again, it works by telling a lie so often and for so long that your victims begin to repeat the lie. They pass it on. The teachers pass on the lie to their students. The parents pass on the lie to their children. Not because it's some conspiracy, not because the teachers and parents are thinking, I'm going to enslave these little minds. They just think they're telling the kids what is. This is reality. This is the world. They pass on the lie because they don't see it as a lie. And that is the power of mass mind control. If you're part of the group that's been controlled and been told this lie all your life, it doesn't look like a lie. It doesn't feel like a lie. It doesn't feel like anything. It just feels like describing what is. When there is that type of lie, basically the only ones able to see it are outsiders, people who didn't go through that, or people who escaped it, who can look at the whole group that repeats the lie over and over again and say, wow, that's insane. How could they believe that? But to the people inside the group, it's not insane, it's not irrational, it's not a lie. It's what everybody knows. And the power of what everybody knows is huge. It isn't what everybody knows, it's what everybody believes. And if you can get an entire group to believe something completely insane, the chances of any of them ever doubting it are very slim. Because when you grow up in a community and everybody you know, the people you love, the people you know, the people you do business with, they all repeat the lie as if it's gospel truth, why would you ever doubt it, no matter how insane it is? Now, I want to give two examples to demonstrate what the results of mind control look like. In the first example, you're going to be the outsider. You're stumbling through a jungle in the middle of nowhere, and you come across a tribe. And you meet them, and for convenience of my analogy, they happen to speak English, but oh well. And you say, howdy, and they say, hey, stranger, come on in. And you think, well, they didn't kill me, so that's a good start. And you live with them for a while, and they seem rational, they get along, they have some pretty impressive technologies. I mean, it's not up to what you're used to, but it's a pretty smooth-running society. They get along, you know, they have arguments every once in a while, but they don't seem to be going to war with any other tribes, and they basically get along. They're pretty darn civilized. And you think, wow, I might hang around here for a while. Then one day, one of these tribes folk says, oh, it's time. Come on, come on. We all got to go to the volcano. Okay. You know, you seem pretty rational. So we all go to the volcano. Yay, and the whole crowd is cheering, and they're all doing their dance, and hooray. And you go up to the volcano, and you don't really know what's going on until right before you notice that some people are up on the very edge throwing someone in. And you go, ah, what just happened? Like, was it some horrible criminal? No, you see, the tribesfolk explained to you, you see, the god of the volcano, he insists that we sacrifice a virgin to him every full moon. So we do. And he takes care of us, and he makes it so our crops grow, and we don't have diseases and things like that. And so you, you know, trying not to offend this tribesperson, you say, well, okay, I see that you believe that, but there's not really a volcano god. It's just, it's a geological, it's just that there's molten rock under the ground, and there are fissures, and sometimes they get up close to the surface, and no, I know you silly foreigners don't understand this stuff, but, you know, you just have to take our word for it. This is necessary. It's for the good of our tribe. It's, you know, we can't help it. We realize it's unfortunate. We don't like having to throw somebody in every month, but, you know, we have to. It's the only way we can survive. And you're trying to politely tell the person, no, it's evil. It's immoral. You're murdering people every month. And you don't need to. It's not necessary. It's not good. It doesn't help. Well, you know, we tried. 1 month, we didn't throw anybody in. And, you know, 2 weeks later, there was an earthquake. And a bunch of our buildings fell over, and there was death and destruction. A big crack opened up, and 100 of us fell in and died. So it's necessary, okay? Just take our word for it. And you say, look, okay, I believe you that there was an earthquake after you didn't do that, but I don't believe there's a connection. That's completely unrelated. That there's not a god of the volcano. The volcano isn't controlling the weather. It's not controlling the earthquakes. It's not controlling your crops. You shouldn't be doing that. It's bad. And eventually the guy in the tribe says, what do you know? You know, you're a stupid outsider. You don't know anything about us. You don't know anything about what we believe. And if you don't like it, if you don't like our culture, just get out. Get out of our jungle. Get lost. And you try to talk to them. How can you not see that what you're doing is insane and horrible and evil? You're killing people. I mean, if you just danced around and prayed to the volcano, okay, that would be one thing, but you're killing people. You're murdering human beings based on this lie. And the tribes folks say, oh, shut up, get lost. So you do, and figure, I can't change their minds, I'm leaving. Now, you might wonder at some point, where did that lie start? where did they get the notion that to survive, you got to fling someone into a volcano every month? Maybe somebody just sort of came up with a theory hundreds of years earlier and said, you know, I think maybe that big rumbling is a god and he's angry. Or maybe some guy in the tribe, some clever guy, thought, you know, if I can make them think that I can talk to the gods, I bet I can get a lot of power and influence out of that. If I can make them start doing these rituals as if there's a god in the volcano and as if I'm his spokesman, that's going to pay off for me. And maybe he did that, maybe he passed it on to his son, and maybe that went year after year, and or maybe it was just somebody made it up. But eventually, it doesn't matter. Because eventually, the ones pushing the lie, the ones who teach the lie, are everybody. And they don't even know why. They don't understand that it's a lie, so they pass it on. And they are incapable of considering the possibility that it's a lie. Now, from our perspective, it's easy to look at the tribe and go, oh, how backwards and primitive and silly and irrational you are, believing this ridiculous myth about God of the volcano. We can ridicule them, we can insult them, and so on and so forth. But now, I'd like you to consider the second example. What lies do we not see because we all believe them? Because we all repeat them? Because we've all heard everybody we know repeating them over and over and over again? No, we don't believe in a volcano god, but what do we believe in that doesn't actually make any sense, but that we've never questioned? In other words, what are the ways in which mind control has been used on us and we haven't noticed? For that example, we don't get to be the outsiders because we're in the group. So this example, an alien comes down to Earth and he lands here and he's looking around and he comes across an Earthling. And the Earthling goes, ooh, ooh, you don't look like one of us. You're from another planet, right? And the alien says, yep, just thought I'd come down and see how you guys are doing, see what your civilization's up to. And the Earthling says, should I take you to our leader? And the alien says, to your what? You know, the guy in charge. The guy in charge of what? The guy in charge of everything. You have one guy in charge of everything? Well, it's not just one, it's a few. You know, government. Government. Well, you know, I came down to see your civilization and, sure, show me this government thing. So you jump in the car and you drive to Washington, D.C. And they get out and the Earthling goes, here it is. And the alien says, okay, where? I'm not sure what I'm looking for. Well, it's all around us. This is where it all happens. Okay, where's this government thing? Well, it's all around us. This is where it happens. Well, I see this huge building here. Is that it? Well, that's the Capitol building. That's where government does its business. In there. Okay, but that's not government, that's just sort of its house or something. Yeah, that's right. That's where it does its thing. Well, could you tell me what this government thing, what does it look like? Like, describe it to me. Well, it doesn't really look like anything. I mean, you can't really see government as a thing. So it's like a gas or something that floats around that's invisible or it hides or something. No, it's not anything like that. It's hard to explain. You can't really see it. You can't really draw a picture of it. All right, well then let's try this approach. What does it do, this government thing? What does it do? Well, it makes the rules for all of us. It tells us what to do. And for those who disobey, it punishes us. Okay, so this thing tells you, human Earthlings, what to do. It bosses you around, and if you disobey, it punishes you. Sounds sort of like a slave master. Oh, no. It works for us. It serves us. We're the boss. It tells you what to do and hurts you if you disobey, and you're its boss. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay, I'm having a little trouble with it. It gives you these rules. It's wise and gives you smart rules all the time, you mean? No, a lot of its rules are really stupid. And it makes us pay for things that they're destructive, they're idiotic, they're evil. So, this thing that serves you by making you do dumb stuff and making you pay for stuff you don't like. Yeah, well, we have to have it. It's necessary for society. So, is it just big and powerful and it can really squish you if you disobey and you're all just scared of this thing? Well, we're sort of scared, but we feel an obligation to obey the law. You know, we're a law-abiding people. We go by the rules. But you just said the rules are sometimes stupid. Yeah, and sometimes we go by the stupid rules, but we have to obey. I mean, it's the law. We're obligated to obey. We can ask government to change the laws, but as long as it's the law, we have to obey. So, you're obligated to do stuff that you think is stupid and destructive. Yeah, but we can ask it to please tell us to do smart things. Okay. Oh, there's a senator. Yeah, yeah, he's a part of government. See the guy? He's getting in the limo. That's a senator. What do you mean? The gray-haired thing getting in the limo right there. Yeah, 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 he's part of government. That's it. That's him. So this government thing, it disguises itself like earthlings to make it easier to deal with you? No, he's just a person. He's a human. He's the same as you, but he's government, and you're not. Is that it? Yeah, well, he's part of government, and we just vote for them. Okay, so he's allowed to boss you around and even tell you to do dumb things, and you're obligated to obey him, even when you think the orders are stupid. Yeah, we can ask him to change his orders, but yeah, we have to obey. You're not allowed to boss him around and take his money, tell him what to do. Oh, no, no, no. They'd put us in cages if we did that. Okay, I'm having trouble with this because I look at you and I look at him. You're the same thing. You're the same species. You're one of the species, and he's another one of the species. But he's government, and you're not. And he's allowed to boss you around, and you're not allowed to boss him around. I don't get, if you're the same thing, why you're not the same thing. Why are the rules different if you're both the same species? Well, maybe I should explain. He's not, all by himself, he's not government. Like, if he came over right now and said, give me 50 bucks or I'll punch you, he's not allowed to do that. He doesn't have the right to do that. If he came over right now just on his own and told me what to do, he can't do that. He's only allowed to do these things when he's acting as government. So he's not government, he's acting as government. So he's pretending to be government? No, I mean acting on behalf of government. Okay, so he's not it anymore. He's not government. There's this other thing called government, and he's acting on behalf of it when he bosses you around and demands your money. Right? Well, yeah, he's a part of it, and he represents it. He's just their agent, sort of. Okay, so you can't really point to him. He's not government anymore. The building, that's not government. The guy, he's not government, he's just acting on behalf of it. And they give you these orders. Yeah, they're called laws, and there's whole libraries full of law books that tell us what we can do and what happens if we disobey. Okay, and they're not government either, they're just books. Yeah, they're just books. So you have the building that isn't government, the people that aren't government, the people who enforce it, is that some different species? No, they're just humans too. Okay. You have enforcers, you have law books, None of them are government, but they all act on behalf of government, whatever it is. Yeah, well, sort of together they are, but sort of together they're not, really. Okay, these laws. Who makes them up? Government makes them up, and then, like, that guy writes it down? The guy who got in the limo? No, he makes it up. He makes up the rules. Him and a bunch of other politicians, they make up the rules, and then they have enforcers they hire to come put us in cages if we disobey. So he's making it up. He's the one thinking them up and writing them down. That human, the thing that's just like you, the human, along with other humans, they're the ones that sit down and make up these commands. Yeah, they make the laws. While claiming to be acting on behalf of a thing called government. Does that thing look like a volcano by any chance? No, why do you ask? Never mind. So humans make up these commands. They tell you to obey. You feel obligated to obey, even when you think they're stupid. I'm still having trouble recognizing the government because I can see all the ingredients you can point out. I can see the law books and the buildings and the enforcers and the politicians, but you keep saying it's something else and you keep not being able to point to it. I mean, I understand, you know, even back on my planet, we have like sports teams and you can say that all these people are on the sports team and together they make up a sports team. But what you're telling me is all these people in buildings, they're part of government, but they're not really it. There's something else that makes it government, and they're not it, but you can't really tell me what it is or where it comes from. So let's try a new approach. They give you these laws, these commands. They tell you what to do. Basically, they threaten you, right? They say you're going to do this or we'll hurt you. Well, yeah, but we don't really view it that way. You know, it's the law of the land. You know, we have to obey it. It's the law of the land. The dirt? The land makes the law? I thought that guy did. Well, yeah, but on behalf of the thing called government, on behalf of the country, he tells us what to do and hurts us if we disobey. Wait, didn't you say he works for you? He does this for your benefit? Yeah. For our benefit, he bosses us around and takes our money. Okay. So you feel an obligation to obey these commands, even if you think they're stupid. Like, can you give me an example of one of the commands that you think are stupid? You don't like, but you think you should go along with it anyway. Well, they make us pay taxes, they demand lots of money from us, and they pay for wars. They pay to pay lots of people to go to the other side of the planet and kill a bunch of people. And I don't like paying for that. Okay, I can see how you wouldn't like that. Doesn't sound like a good thing to me, the way you described it. But you feel obligated to give them your money. Like it's a bad thing if you don't. Yeah. You feel obligated to fund what you consider to be murder. You think it's bad for you not to fund murder. In a way... Okay, let me back up for a minute. Do you earthlings, do you generally accept that stealing from each other and beating each other up and murdering each other for no reason, are you guys to the point where you kind of understand that that's not a good thing? Oh, yeah, we know that. You know, you don't steal, don't attack, don't assault. Don't do that horrible thing. Okay, but when the guy who got in the limo, when he says, give us money so we can go kill people, you feel obligated to go along with it and to give him money. Well, that's different. That's not just somebody doing it. That's authority doing it. That's government doing it. Okay, now, I'm assuming you're just scared of this thing. It's a big, horrible, powerful thing. So, like, how many people does it take money from to pay for this war, among other things? About 100 million of us. 100 million of you. So it must have, you know, 100 million enforcers to make you guys pay up? No, I think there are about 100,000 tax collectors for the federal government. So you outnumber them 1,000 to 1, but you still feel obligated to give them your money to fund things you think are evil. Well, yeah, we can ask them to change their commands, of course. We're allowed to ask them to tell us to do what we want them to tell us to do. Okay, so let me get this straight. You sent them there. You decided that some of you should go there and boss you around and take your money. And your goal is to pick somebody who's going to order you to do what you were going to do anyway. But what happens every time is he orders you to do something else, and then you try to make somebody else go there who's going to boss you around and command you to do things that are in line with your own beliefs and morals and things like that. Is that how it works? Yeah, pretty much. They boss us around, and we try to put people there who are going to tell us to do what we wanted to do in the first place. Okay, now, I realize I'm new to this planet, and this seems sort of strange to me, but I got to ask you a question. Instead of you trying to pick one of you to put there to boss you around and take your money in the hopes that he's going to do it and command you to do the things that you think are right anyway, why don't you do what we do on our planet, which is you do what you think is right, and that's all. On my planet, you know, we have conflicts and stuff, but we each do what we think is right. We spend our own money. We make up our own decisions. Why would you try to take a person, put him in a position where he can force you to do something and try to get someone who's going to force you to do what you were going to do anyway? I don't get why you do that. Well, no, we can't. You can't have everyone deciding for himself what he's going to do. That's anarchy. There'd be chaos and mayhem, and you didn't have laws if you didn't have government. It's just, and it would never work. It would never work. So, in order to keep you humans civilized, in order to keep you from attacking and stealing and murdering each other, you choose some of you to go over there who then attack you and steal from you and murder you so that nobody will attack you and steal from you and murder you, because if they didn't, somebody might attack you and steal from you and murder you. Is that right? Yeah, that about sums it up. See, we humans, if left to our own devices, we're untrustworthy. You know, some of us are just negligent, some of us are nasty, you know, some of us would hurt each other. But you said you understand you shouldn't steal and murder and stuff like that. Well, yeah, most of us understand that, and most of us get along pretty well, but there are a few of us who they will steal and beat people up and even murder people. Right, I can see how that would be a problem. And so that's why we need government, because some people do that. So you need this thing that steals from you and bosses you around and occasionally murders people. You need that because sometimes a few people, not very many, might decide to steal from you and boss you around and murder people. So you need an organization that does that first so somebody else doesn't do it. I'm new to this planet. I'm sorry I'm having a hard time understanding this. It's tough. Well, you know, we're untrustworthy. We're imperfect. You know, like I said, mostly we get along, but there are those little problems, and we need somebody in charge. We need government in charge to keep us civilized. Okay, so I assume you put the wisest, most noble, most compassionate people into power so that they will use their wisdom to keep the rest of you in line. Still doesn't really make sense, but at least you have the best among you going there, right? No. Actually, they're all a bunch of lying crooks. The ones you sent there. Well, we don't try to elect lying crooks, but it always turns out that way. And they always get caught doing nasty, horrible things, and they're constantly doing things we don't like with our money, whether it's, you know, giving money to people who are already zillionaires, or waging war, or taking money from people who earn it to give it to people who didn't, or other things like that. Yeah, they are constantly doing that stuff. They're completely corrupt. They're a bunch of lying crooks. Okay, so let me see one last time if I can understand this. Because human beings are untrustworthy, some of them, because they're sometimes negligent or nasty, because there's the threat that some of your neighbors might boss you around or steal from you or even kill you, because of that, it is necessary for your survival to take some of the worst people among you and give them permission to steal from you, boss you around, and kill people. Is that about sum it up? Yeah, that's pretty much government in a nutshell. Okay, tell you what, we'll come back to your planet in a few hundred years and see if you have any grasp on reality by then. See you later. Alien flies away. This is the mind control that most people don't see. If you believe there is such a thing as government, you are the victim of mind control. Government is no more real than the volcano god. The guy in the limo, when he and his fellow lying crooks issue a command to you and all your neighbors, if you imagine that to be law and imagine disobedience to his commands to be crime, you are the victim of mind control. If you actually believe that you can ever have a moral obligation to do the wrong thing, to fund something you think is evil, you are the victim of mind control. Now, the good news, if it can be called that, is so is everybody else around you. Because everyone else believes it. Everyone else takes pride in being a law-abiding taxpayer, which means I obey the lying crooks and I give them my money. Okay, not really a good reason to be proud, but oh well. The trouble is, I think a bunch of people in this room, they can see it. They understand that mind control and they can see through it and are now outsiders from that game. Most of the country isn't. Most of the country, if you tell them there isn't a volcano god, I mean, there isn't a government, they'll say, you're ridiculous, get out of here, we need it. Yeah, but it does nasty things, it kills people, it steals from you. Hey, if we didn't have that, there would be chaos and death and destruction. We need it. We can look at the silly tribe that believes in the volcano god. How can you be so dumb as to throw a person into a volcano every month? But you know, a lot more than one person a month gets murdered by the people who pretend to be our rightful rulers. If we were the tribe that worshiped the volcano god, we'd be miles ahead of where we are now. We can laugh at them. We can pretend that we're too wise for that. And then we can go vote for the next crook who's going to steal our money and clobber us over the head and tell us what to do and murder people. The fact that we all believe it, that we all repeat it, that we heard it in school, that we hear it from our parents, from our teachers, from people who care about us, it doesn't mean it's true. And the truth of the matter is, it's not that tough to demonstrate that the belief in government and calling the politicians' commands laws and calling their demands for money taxes, it doesn't make any sense. It makes less sense than believing in a volcano god. Because at least a volcano god, in order to prove there isn't one, you'd have to like dig up the volcano and go, see, no god, just a bunch of molten rock. But it's very easy to go through lines of reasoning just on what people know already to demonstrate that the people who call themselves government cannot possibly have the right to rule. Just like the alien was baffled, they cannot possibly have any right that you don't personally have. If you don't have the right to tax, they don't have the right to tax, because where would they have gotten it? If we all started as humans, all men are created equal, and suddenly Congress shall have the power to tax. What the heck happened in between? How did we get unequal again? Some are more equal than others. It's very simple to prove that everyone in this country at one point or another was a victim of mind control, but it's very difficult for them to see it because the lie is everywhere and they don't want to see that their entire life and their entire belief system is based on a lie. And the worst part is that this lie takes the virtues of good people. It takes their good qualities, their productivity, and their honor, and turns it into fuel for some of the most evil people in the world. If it was merely dancing around a volcano, who cares? But the belief in government kills. It robs, it extorts, it assaults. It violates every right you could possibly imagine, including the right to be alive. This is why I refer to the belief in government as the most dangerous superstition. It's not just a rational construct. It's not just a way to organize and get along. It's not a way to cooperate. It's a hallucination of something that is not there, a group of the right to rule. Let me end on this. Government is the volcano god. And you can imagine if you just wandered through a jungle and found this tribe, how frustrating it would be to watch them throwing somebody into a volcano, somebody perfectly innocent, trying to explain to them their entire view of what that volcano is completely backwards. It's completely bogus. It's just, it's rock and lava. It's not a god. You don't have to do this. This isn't doing you any good. And it's easy to picture how frustrating that would be. And my question is, are we Americans any more open to reason than the volcano worshippers? Most of us aren't. And you can see that when you try to deprogram someone from their own lie, their own universally accepted lie. They don't believe in the volcano god, they just believe in something that's about 100,000 times more destructive. We can think we're smarter than that tribe as we murder tens of thousands of people at a time that haven't done anything to us. We can think we're smarter than that tribe as we imagine legitimacy to a group of people stealing trillions of dollars and doing destructive, evil, idiotic things with it. We are not sane beings until we accept that we each own ourselves. We do not behave in a sane manner as long as we believe in authority. Because when you believe in authority, you actually really and truly believe that you have an obligation to do what you think is wrong. Because whenever there's a conflict between your own judgment and authority, if you choose authority, you are choosing evil. And humanity has been doing it for a long, long time. It's why every war has happened. Every example of widespread oppression. It's because we imagine a thing that is no more real than a volcano god. Thank you.
Larkin, that was an amazingly short 39 minutes, and here we are back. But here you are. You've given this lecture. The aliens' logic wins. You know, as Spock won out, the humans' logic failed again. And so, you know, basically, where do we go from here? What's the course of action?
Really, my goal is to sort of put people in the position of that earthling, of look at what you actually believe. Don't just, you know, you hear it in civics class, you're taught to repeat things. They don't make any sense. They contradict themselves. But you're taught these things and you say them and everybody else says them and you pretend it makes sense and you pretend you understand them. Basically, I want people to look at their beliefs in government until they actually understand it. Because when they do, the beliefs won't be there anymore. Because you cannot believe in government without having a self-contradictory belief system. And I know that's going to sound weird to people. It would have sounded weird to me for the years and years and years and years that I believed in government and law and authority.
Well, I think you just did in your presentation that we just played, I think you did, a clean enough job that people should really get that concept by now. It shouldn't sound too weird right now.
Yeah, you'd hope. But just, you know, right out of the box to think, well, no, some government, you'd have to have something. And because people are so stuck inside that paradigm that to suggest that they be all the way outside that paradigm is too troubling. But basically, that's where they end up if they just look at their own belief system and try to make it consistent with itself. And that's why I got here, because I saw little flaws. I was, you know, conservative or constitutionalist, libertarian leaning. And so I'd have debates, because I always like debating with people, and I would notice contradictions inside my own beliefs. And after the fun debate, I'd go somewhere and think, all right, I have this contradiction. Let me look at it carefully, because something's got to go. I have two beliefs. They don't match each other. Something's got to go. Well, if you keep doing that, eventually the entire mythology of government disappears. It's just gone. And it's not, I didn't come to being a anarchist, is sort of the scary word for it. Voluntarist is the nicer sounding word for it. I didn't get to that point by deciding that human beings would do things better without a ruling class. I got there by realizing ruling classes can't be legitimate, no matter what. They can't have authority. Their commands can't be law. And without authority, they can't be government. It's a gang of thugs. I didn't come to the, basically for me, it didn't end up as a choice between, which of these will work better? And the analogy I often use is today, I don't look at Christmas and say, well, let's see, should we do it with Santa Claus or without? There's not a choice. We don't have him. And that is the reality about government. It's not a choice of do we have it or don't we? We don't. It doesn't exist. It can't exist. The entire belief and all of the mythology surrounding it doesn't make any sense. And it conflicts with the moral code and the logic of everybody. And I don't care if you're talking Christians, Muslims, atheists, anything.
Well, you know, let's not forget, Larkin, and I've looked a lot into this over the last several months, but the word government, governmente, originally in Mid and Old English, means mind control. And some people will argue that the ment on the end is simply a suffix like employment or something like that. But the word govern or gubernare is to steer or control. So what other than the human mind is government meant to steer or control? So really, to claim that the ment or mente is simply a suffix and not ment for, or mente for Latin for mind, is really a slap in the face, because no matter how you break it down, the word government in and of itself means mind control.
Means mind control, and it's perfectly labeled.
Right, and if you look in the Oxford English Dictionary and you look at the descriptions of it, it says, you know, control the behavior and, you know, the religion and the actions of others and all of these different aspects. It is at face, you know, slap in the face value, for that matter, mind control.
Yeah.
And, you know, but so many people will argue, try and argue that suffix point of government rather than, you know, governmente, but I always beg people to please provide me a single example where government is not used for mind control in the political sense, and they can't do it.
Right, right. And that's the thing. My first and most recent book, which sounds weird, but basically it's the first book I started 15 years ago, and it just came out, called The Most Dangerous Superstition. It's about the belief in authority, which mostly today shows up as the belief in government. Churches used to claim the right to rule people, but now mostly it's government.
You know, I'm going to interrupt you really quickly because, you know, the appeal to authority is a logical fallacy in and of itself, which, you know, and that's why I wanted to have you on the show, because of the trivium. And the trivium, specifically in this order, is grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And as you were doing earlier, you were removing the contradictions that you found in your own thought processes when you're debating other people. So you remove those contradictions, which is the logic aspect. And here you're presenting this dialectic, and logic is also known as the dialectic. And of course, you're using rhetoric to express what you've learned in that dialectic to others. You know, so that's really the key of why I wanted you on the show. So here you're doing all of this work that's really founded in the trivium in and of itself, and the biggest one, like you were just saying, this appeal to authority fallacy of the government.
Right, and the fact that the even all those people, because everybody today points at, you know, the current United States government and says, oh, look at the horrible things it's doing. You know, people complain about different horrible things it's doing, depending on whether they're politically left or right or moderate or whatever they call themselves. But what they don't get, and the only way to get it is what you're talking about by logic and grammar and rhetoric, is that the power of that thing that they're pointing at, to whether it's to save them or to complain about it, it's all illusion. It's all hallucination. It's all mind control. Every bit of the power of government is mind control by making people hallucinate legitimacy and authority, which doesn't make sense, and it contradicts itself. So yeah, what I do using logic and grammar, and grammar is a huge one, because the grammar and rhetoric, they sort of tie together.
But you always have to remember, too, just to point this out for the audience, that it does always need to be in a specific order, because grammar is like the building blocks of like an engine or a car or a house or whatever. Logic is that house put together, all the contradictions removed, and then rhetoric would be like the architect's manual or the owner's manual of how it all went together and explaining how it all works.
Right. And if you look at the mythology about government through each of those steps, it falls apart and explodes all over the place. If you start with literally stating reality, not the things we're taught to echo, consent of the governed and representative and law and yada, yada, yada. If you just step through it for, you know, expressing concepts, language, making sure the concepts actually match and fit logic, and then the sort of the final message, it doesn't, if you just take people back through the belief system they already have and try to get them to express it literally accurately without the euphemisms and the propaganda and all these weird sayings we're taught to memorize and repeat as if they make sense. If you just try to get them, you know, like we just heard in the back and forth with the alien, if you just try to get them to explain their own beliefs in a rational way, they explode all over the place. And that's really all I want to do. You know, a lot of people, the debate is, you believe A and I believe B, and I want to bludgeon you over the head until you believe B. And that's not what I'm doing. Luckily, that's not what I have to do, because that never works. I'm telling people, you believe A and you believe B, and A and B are mutually logically exclusive. So please look at your own beliefs and pick one, because you can't have both. And anybody who still believes
remove
in authority
the contradiction.
Has both. Exactly. If you remove the contradictions, the mythology of authority and government evaporates, and then it's gone. And then you go, oh yeah, the world completely isn't what I always imagined it to be. In fact, I'm not what I imagined myself to be, because suddenly I don't have an owner. I don't have a master. It's just me. And that's, on the one hand, it's very freeing. And on the other hand, it's a little bit scary, because suddenly you have to be a responsible, like, sentient being instead of just a sheep in a pasture. But it's worth it, folks, to be actually rational and have a consistent belief system.
Larkin, what is the single most important concept that you would like people to take away from this interview and lecture?
I guess if I had to sum it up, it would be there's no such thing as authority, and when you hallucinate an authority, especially in the form of government and laws, and when you hallucinate an obligation to obey someone else's judgment, when you hallucinate a right of somebody else to control you, you betray yourself. You betray your own moral code. You betray your own responsibility, your own ethics, your own morals, your own logic. You betray everything about you. Basically, you reduce yourself to a slave of somebody else. And as much as you were taught that that's necessary, it's not necessary. It's not good. It doesn't help humanity or civilization. I guess that would about be it.
All right, and would you like to give out your website and the titles of your books and DVD, etc.?
Yeah, my website is larkenrose.com. That's LarkenRose.com. And there's a bunch of free articles there. My new radio show, Outside the Cage, there's a link for that at the top of the front page. And you can hear the past shows. They were actually designed to target people who haven't thought about these things before. And a few people, after listening to them, say, hey, this is something I actually dare to play to my normal friends and acquaintances to make them start thinking about these things. And then on LarkinRose.com, you can also get three of my books. The first one is How to Be a Successful Tyrant. The second one is my novel, The Iron Web. Which I won't give away too much of the plot, but it's basically about the end of the United States.
Yeah, and I've heard a good chunk of that. It's very good, and your cousin shared quite a bit of that with me.
Cool. And then the most recent one, the most important thing I've ever written, is The Most Dangerous Superstition, which really tears to the heart of the irrational, self-contradictory basis of the belief system of almost everyone, not just in the country, but in the world.
For more than a year, which would be to the end of 44. By that time, we were ready to take over and move them in and so forth. Now, in that group, there were 55 who already had PhDs. You see? Mm-hmm. So it was a very good group. The only one I had any trouble with had been a district attorney in Indiana and a Republican politician. And I had trouble with him over certain things. For example, the Civil War in Spain. I gave him the truth of the Civil War in Spain. I mean, this was not a communist revolt against the Catholic Church or something like this, you see, and that's what this guy was. So, this is the substance of the book, Tragedy and Hope. Do you
see? Did you know while you were working at this?
No. I was just trying to, you know, keep a day-to-day basis.
But you realize at the end of the accumulation of research and...
Well, yes, I knew, I knew a hell of a lot more about most of this than most people. Mm-hmm. Now, I then spent 20 years writing it, from 45 to 65, and put it in, do you see, in 65. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, I had written a shorter book, which 15 publishers had rejected, and I had set it aside. I wrote it the first time in the only summer I had off, which was 1942, in that whole period. I went for 20 years without any time off, no sabbaticals, no anything, from 42 to 61, when I took off and went to England to research. And then I got another sabbatical in 71, when I again went to England on a sabbatical. And they only sabbatical time, whether I'll get or not, I've asked for one semester of sabbatical before I retire. That simply means I get full pay for one semester. It seems to be half pay or whatever it is. I don't know what it is. I can't even look in. I don't have time to look into it. But in any case, I worked out all of these things, and my first book had been rejected by 15 publishers. I had written it first in the summer of 34. I then spent the summer of 42 in Princeton in Donald Stauffer's, and he died as Eastman Professor of Literature at Oxford after climbing the Pyrenees, running up and down the Pyrenees. And I wrote it in 42. Then I set that aside and wrote it a third time, just dashed it off. And that is the book, The Evolution of Civilizations. It's only 279 pages, but it's still the best thing. And there are a number of books that quote it as the best thing on why civilizations rise and fall and how they do and so forth. So it's a big thing, you see. Now, this world since 1914 covers 70 years, from 1895 to 1965, and it's in that way, but it covers the whole world. So again, it's a pretty big thing because it goes into science and technology, as you will discover if you start reading the paperback, and economics. And as you see, I can do more in economics than economists can.
Well, one thing that intrigues, well, just last night my wife and I were talking about it, was the title of the book, Tragedy and Hope.
And Hope, yes. Because
it's such a large title.
Yes. Now, what it means is this. I think it is absolutely tragic. It is shameful. It is sinful that Western civilization is going to go down the drain. When I wrote that book, which is less than 10 years ago, I had hope that we could save Western civilization. I am extremely skeptical now that it can be saved. I think we're just about finished. And I just threw a few things out here this morning in the class. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're going to allow a coal strike and if we're going to overthrow the Portuguese government. Because as soon as all these military dictatorships are not going to last. Mm-hmm. And so we get rid of a democracy because it wants to be a little liberal. Mm-hmm. We put in a military dictatorship, within collapses, and what happens? The communists come in. This is what happened in Portugal. Salazar was there since 1927. You see? Mm-hmm. All right, now they suddenly try to establish some kind of a non-military dictatorship. He wasn't a military, he was a college professor. But he was supported by the reactionary groups. And now they want to do something about that. And the same thing could happen in Greece. They're now going to probably, in Greece, try these generals who established the military dictatorship because we got them to do it. Mm-hmm. You see? And this gives the communists, and it could well be. Now, this is what's worrying Kissinger. He thinks the whole Mediterranean now is going to become communist. So we're going to go into war to prevent this? Oh, I mean, it's sick.
Now, when did you find a publisher for your book?
I found a publisher instantly, because the first book, I'm a current history, an editor. And I used to write a good deal for them. And that's who called me up one Monday and wants me to write about Spain today, what's going to happen in Spain. And I said, it would take too much time, I don't do it. So the people at Current History said to me in 1960, I just mentioned I had this book, I had many books. I have a whole lot of books, the half written and almost wholly written, you see. And they said, are you ever going to ask Peter Ritten? And I said, I never heard of him. Who was he? Call him up, Hat McMillan. So right to the phone, I was at the American Historical Association in New York, the meeting of 1960, and I went to the phone and called McMillan and asked for Peter Ritner, and he came on, and I said, I have a book, and I have somebody here who's the editor of Current History, says that you would like it, and so forth. He said, send it to me. A week later, I got a letter from him. It's a marvelous book.
How many pages did you send him?
I sent him the whole thing.
Which was...
And well,
just fat.
Yeah, just about that fat. It came out as a book of 279 printed pages. Accepted it within a week.
Which book is this then?
This is the first one.
First book, okay. Right, okay.
This is 1961. You find all of this in Who's Who. You see the dates.
Yes.
You see. All right. That's how I got my first book published. Now, when I signed the contract for that, 1961, they made me agree that I would give them my next book.
Sure.
You see? So in a couple of years, I said to Peter Ritten, I want the next book to be The World Since 1914. And he said, okay, let's sign a contract.
He didn't say anything like that's a rather large subject, Carol?
Peter Ritten thinks I am the greatest writer around.
Okay, is he an editor then?
He's gone. That's him.
Okay.
You see, now here's what happened. And I don't know whether we want to get this on tape, but I'll put it on tape. But look, you've got to be discreet.
Sure.
You know, you have to protect my future.
Sure.
As well as your own.
Sure.
All right. When Tragedy and Hope was signed the contract, and right up to the last minute, which would be the spring and summer of 66, they were planning to bring it out in two volumes, boxed, for $17.50. Mm-hmm. Macmillan had been bought from Harold Macmillan at the Macmillan Company of England for $5 million, because he needed the cash. In the summer of 66, a holding company, Collier Books, which originally was Morgan, and they published Collier's Magazine. Remember Collier's Weekly and so on? All right. Collier's Books, now I don't know who controls it now, and it's one of these holding companies, came in, they bought up the Free Press, you know, in Illinois, they bought up Brentano Bookstores, they bought up Macmillan. They came in and they looked at what they'd bought and they said, you're spending money wildly, you're not taking in money, we got to stop it.
The accountants
took over. Yeah. So they said, no advertising on any books that are published for the next 6 months. You spent too much on advertising. And the editors like Peter Ritner screamed and said, we've got them to stay if this is the way you're going to do things. So they said, all right, one ad for each book. All right, I got one ad for Tragedy and Hope. And it was a quarter page in the New York Times book review, I believe. That's all.
How do you spell Ritner's name?
R-I-T-N-E-R. Okay. Peter Ritner. I imagine he's in Who's Who. He should be. Anyway, he has since left them. I don't know what he is doing. He still lives in the same place that I visited him in Riverside Drive up near the George Washington Bridge. But he works for some world book thing of something.
There's a world publisher.
Something else. And what he does, I don't know, because he's never got in touch with me since he left.
And they also did not come out with the two lines.
No. When they saw it, they said, oh, this is going to cost too much. Cut it to one volume and cut the price $5. So that made it $12.50, but they never sold it at $12.50. They made it $12.95, so this is what it was sold. Now, it went out of print. That was 66. It went out of print in 68. But in 68, Collier Books got in touch with me, I don't know how or why, and said, we'll bring out the last half of this as a paperback, and that's what I gave you. That came out in 68.
Right.
And that, I think, is still in print. But I can't get a straight answer to any question from them. For example, they never told me until 1974, when I was trying to fight the pirate who reprinted Tragedy and Hope, that it had been out of print. They told me it's out of stock, and we will republish when we get 2,000.
Right.
But they never could get 2,000. I've told you this, haven't I? Because they were telling everybody who wrote in that it's out of print.
Now,
when they denied it to me.
When did you realize there was a pirate edition? How did you find out?
I found out when somebody got a plain envelope with a slip of paper in it, available again, in short supply, Tragedy and Hope.
The whole book.
The whole book. And
they came to you and
no, they called me up and said, did you know that your book is reprinted? I said, which book? Because the book had a print. And they said, Tragedy and Hope. I said, no, it isn't.
You don't know who this person was?
No. Because it's exact copy. Exact. The dust jacket, everything, the binding is the same.
Did they reset the type or is it
photo reproduction? It's exactly the same.
Okay.
Now, I can tell instantly that it's different. Because they didn't notice that the original had a gold, had yellow top on the pages. Yeah.
All right.
You see, the original.
Right.
The new one is white.
So you, I would imagine, would call McMillan and say, hey, you must be upset with the reprint. I mean, that would be a logical
reaction. They didn't give a damn, and I'll tell you why.
But did you call... Now, how much is... Well, we'll talk when we're done with it. I'll ask you how much of this you're comfortable with in light of your lawsuit, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, well,
okay.
I don't know.
We can talk about that.
And I don't know why the villain acted like this. Now, immediately...
But my logical reaction would be to call McMillan and say, gee, you must really be helped.
I didn't. Not right away, I didn't, because they had lied to me so many times and so many
years. Already knew it was...
I did something funny. They had lied to me, you see. On everything. And I have letters to prove that, because I have from written letters apologizing for information previously given to him, because they had lied to him when he called up to ask if they're out of print or not, you see, and they said no and so forth. Now, the big thing is, my contract both had in it that if it went out of print, I had the right to recover the plates.
Right.
They never got in touch with me for the plates. I learned in March of this year that they destroyed the plates of Tragedy and Hope. I learned in the summer, 1971, because my wife got mad and called McMillan on the phone every week while I was in England, and finally got from them a letter in which they said the plates had been destroyed. They had inadvertently destroyed the plates of the first book, Evolution of Civilizations, you see?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you find, so a guy called you, an anonymous caller.
He identified himself, you know, to me, but he's no. And he gave me his name and so forth, and he had got this. And, you want to shut that off?
Okay.
A second. And the way I found out was, I sent an order. I let somebody else send an order. Now, this was my assistant who sent a check. Sent an order. And nothing came. And then we discovered they'd only pay if you sent them cash ahead of time. You see?
A check wouldn't do?
Well, I guess I did send a check.
But not the whole thing.
No, I sent the check, the whole thing. But they, for example, will not send to bookstores unless they send cash. And they're all suspicious. Because if you order 10 copies, and that would be $120, because he was asking 12, you could vanish, because there's no way to find out who it is.
Sure.
You have no name. You have a box number in California and so forth. And anyway, I couldn't find out anything. I got it back, and I was shocked because it was identical. You see, almost identical. So then I got other companies were offering it.
When is this now?
This was in this year.
This year?
Yes, January.
January
1974.
Okay.
This year. By March, somebody came to me and had one of the pirate copies. I said, where'd you get it? And they said, Sidney Kramer. I said, does he have it? And he said, sure, he had 4 or 5 in there. So I called up Sidney Kramer and asked if he had it, and he said yes, and I went down there, and he's very hard to get information out, but finally I found out that he sent an order in, and they sent me a check, and I'll send it, you see?
Mm-hmm.
And he sold them and repeated the order and so forth. So then I told our bookstore.
He's using the same address you have?
Yes, he was
using.
You still
don't know who it is? And at that time you did not know who it is?
I still am not certain.
Really?
Who it is. And I will now, and I'll tell you why. One of the places that was offering it for sale, and there was about 5 places that were offering it for sale, and I've got since a number of others, that they come to me from students, or they don't write to me directly ever. Now, no one ever approached me. Well, one reason I was suspicious of McMillan was this. The first, the fact that the radical right, the John Birch Society and so forth, was getting all up over this book, goes back to at least 69.
I was going to ask you about that.
69. Yes, and a book appeared called The Naked Capitalist by Skousens. Now, of that book, about a fifth of it is direct quote from my book. Now, he says it's from my book, it's in quotation marks, but nevertheless it's a violation of copyright. I got in touch with Macmillan, they would not do a thing. They said, I said, aren't you going to defend my copyright? They said, no, if you want to do something, we will support you and, you know, and be a witness if you want and so forth. Well, I wasn't going to sue this guy. He's a professor of religion at Brigham Young University, former police chief of Salt Lake City, you know,
He's on the gamut.
So whether he has, and he's been in the FBI for years.
Right.
So whether he would have any money, it wouldn't be worth my while to sue him, do you see, probably. And another state and so forth. So I decided I'd let that go, but then I discovered they wouldn't do anything. And then Congressman Rarick, who was beaten in the primary just now, put that book into the congressional record, and a lot of things like this. Then this book was distributed to every registered voter in New Hampshire.
At no point, they never called you and said, and asked for a quote. I mean,
no, nobody ever.
It'd be like telling a story without ever talking to you.
Yeah. Nobody ever wrote to me about this.
Hmm? Do you know where they got the picture of you from the PR office?
I think, let me see which picture it is. They tried to get pictures from the PR office, and I said, don't give anybody a picture if they won't tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they got this from the PR office. Mm-hmm. Now, Skousens couldn't get a picture of me. Mm-hmm. You see, they could have got a picture off the back of the full picture of me, on the back of the jacket of the first book,
mm-hmm.
from Backrack,
mm-hmm.
here in town. But, you know, that's the one they have in the public relations office here now, still. It's the only one there is, and that's where they got that. Well, it's all right, but then they put it on the same page with J.P. Morley, you know, this is nonsense to me. Now, I mean, you're right to laugh. It's a joke, but it's also silly,
yeah.
linking me with Morgan or with any of these people. But then they're full of statement. Anyway, Rarick and other people filled the congressional record with this. Then the Joint Birch Society started talking about it in their various publications. And then, of course, this guy is a John Birch employee.
Yeah.
And he published even before this, did he? The book, Nixon, The Man Behind the Mask. Yeah, that's in 69. Now, I knew nothing about that until 2 weeks ago.
Really?
Nixon, The Man Behind the Mask. When one of the priests here met me and said, I've been looking for you. I said, well, look, it's free. Go ahead and look all you want. He said, no, I want to ask you about this Gary Allen who wrote a book about Nixon. And I said, well, I know Gary Allen. I didn't know he wrote a book about Nixon, so I don't keep up with this stuff. And he said, well, I have it, and the whole third chapter is about you and your book, Trash and Hope. I said, really? So he let me have it, and I read it, and it was. And now there's others that are...
You don't know Gary Allen personally.
No. Now, here's what happened. A crisis occurred at Brigham Young, and I should not go into it in detail because I don't know anything for sure.
Yeah, I know something...
The campus was blown apart by a fight between the political science department and Skousens, in which they declared he was unworthy to be a Mormon professor and should be fired.
Right.
And he defended himself, and what happened, I do not know. All I know is this.
He lost it.
Who?
He lost it.
Oh, did he?
He got ousted.
Oh, I didn't know that. You see, I never find out. Nobody ever tells me these things.
I'll check. Former chief police officer, actually, I quite weird about the Rich Rally.
He did get rid of him, huh?
He did. I think he lost that fight in the University option. I never would have.
Well, anyway, the reason, all I know about it is this. I gave three papers at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I'm going to give you one of them. And because they liked it so much, they printed thousands of them. Or, you know, processed thousands of them and distributed them to all the press, in the press room. They liked this one, so it wasn't the best of them. General Crises and Civilization, you know, which this is an attractive title. Now, somebody called me up and wanted to talk to me at this. And I think it was at this. And he said his name was Larson, and he was a scientist from Brigham Young, and he wanted to see and talk to me because of what was going on up there. I said, well, what is going on up there? Oh, he says they have mass meetings on this, and he says it's just an uproar all the time. Well, I didn't know. Now, he made an interview with me, and he wanted to play it on the campus radio or the local radio station, and I said, all right.
What was the interview about?
About Skousens controversy.
Okay.
And I said, all right, let me know what happens. But he never wrote to me. I never found out.
Mm.
I never made any effort, so I don't know whether it was ever broadcast or not.
What was your input in that? What did you have to say about the Skousens controversy?
Well, I simply said...
Your book.
I simply told him that Spoosens wrote this book. He never talked to me about it. He violated my copyright. It's full of lies and things that are untrue. It takes things out of context and misinterprets them. And I gave him the specific things where I disagree. The group that I'm writing about was originally, in my mind, the group established secretly by Lord Milner in 1989 called the Round Table Group, which still publishes a quarterly magazine called the Round Table in London, which is one of the world's best sources of international relations information since 1910. The first editor of it was Lord Lothian, at that time Philip Carr, K-E-R-R, and nobody knew this really for years. I got to know things, and I investigated that group, you see?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how I found it is very interesting. I noticed that prominent people in English life had Fellow of All Souls College. Lord Halifax, who was the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, and then they made him ambassador to America. When they take the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs and makes him ambassador to Washington, which most people would consider a downward step, it shows how important they considered Washington's support would be in World War II, you see? Mm-hmm. He's a Fellow of All Souls. The fellow who summoned Neville Chamberlain on the 10th of May, 1940, and said, "For God's sake, go," was Leo Amery. All right, he was a sidekick, the chief lieutenant, political lieutenant of Lord Milner. You see, mm-hmm. He was a Fellow of All Souls. And so I decided I would study All Souls. This is purely historical. I got the names of all the people who had been Fellows of All Souls since 1899 to whenever I was doing it, which would be about 1947. And there were 149 of them. I discovered most of them were Fellows for only 7 years, which is the regular appointment. It's for 7 years. But some of them were for 55 years Fellows of All Souls. A man named Dougal Malcolm, who was the head of the British South Africa Company, which is what Rhodesia, you see. And he was for 55 years. I discovered that Lord Brand, who had been with Milner in South Africa, was for years, and he was the head of Lazar Brothers Bankers in London. And I discovered that Leo Amery was for years, and so forth. And above all, I discovered a man named Lionel Curtis, who had no right whatever to be a Fellow of All Souls. You get to be a Fellow of All Souls either because you are a very prominent person, and as an honorary thing, you will become an honorary fellow for 7 years, or because you are an outstanding scholar, and you get it by competitive examination when you graduate. That's how Lord Halifax got it. His name was Charles Wood. In 1903, when he graduated from Oxford, he took a competitive examination and got it. But he's kept it. Now, I discovered he kept it because he went immediately to South Africa and met the kindergarten, which was the group of people that were running South Africa for Lord Milner, you see. They were called kindergarten because they were all young kids,
mm-hmm.
you see. Now, these are the ones who remain forever after Fellows of All Souls, or in Lionel Curtis's case, he's the man who said, "We've got to change the name from British Empire to Commonwealth of Nations." And the reason is they had been students of Alfred Zimmern, who wrote a book in 1909 called The Greek Commonwealth, describing ancient Greece, you see,
mm-hmm.
and who was the man who made Arnold Toynbee a great classical scholar, do you see, and brought him into international affairs. Now, I knew none of this.
Mm-hmm.
All I knew is that here was a fellow, Lionel Curtis, who was such a poor student, it took him 15 years to get his degree, and then he got it about the lowest pass degree or something that you could ever get.
Mm-hmm.
And
here he wasn't.
And nobody knew it. Nobody had ever heard of him.
Right. But he was
furthermore,
in the company.
I later discovered, furthermore, he was Lord Halifax's roommate at All Souls for years. And then I discovered this fella is behind everything that's going on. Lionel Curtis, you see? Now, I don't think we should talk too much about this.
Well, no, I...
You see? All right. But having discovered that, I met Alfred Zimmern. He came here to give a speech. And I said, "Isn't it funny that All Souls..." He said, "That's the Roundtable Group." I had never heard of them. That shows how little I knew. They'd been around since 1909 and published this magazine since 1910, and this is 1947.
Mm.
And I said, "What is the Roundtable Group?" He named them. Who they were. And he says, "I was a member of them for 10 years, from 1913, and they brought me in and invited me because I was in the Workers' Education Alliance. This was extension programs, night courses, summer courses for workers, Workers' Education Alliance." And he said, "That's why they brought me into it, and I was for 10 years, and," he says, "I resigned in 1923 because they were determined to build up Germany against France. He said, I wouldn't stand for it, so I resigned. Now, when I met Lord Brennan later and asked him about this, he had never seen the letter of resignation. Now, so I better stop talking because, you see, this gets into all kinds of things. Now, this is, I knew the Round Table Group was very influential. I knew that they were the real founders of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and I knew they were the, all the stuff that's in print, that they were the real founders of the Institute of Pacific Relations. I knew that they were the godfathers of the Council on Foreign Relations here. Mm-hmm. I knew that, for example, you know the big study of history, many volumes of Arnold Toynbee? Mm-hmm. All right. I knew the manuscripts of that were stored in the Council on Foreign Relations during the war so they wouldn't be destroyed by German bombing, do you see? Mm-hmm. And so forth. And so forth. So I began to put these things together and discovered that this group was working for the following things. They were a secret group. They were working to federate the English-speaking world, mm-hmm. the English-speaking world. Mm-hmm. They were closely linked to international bankers. They were working to establish a world, what I call a three-power world. And that three-power world was the Atlantic Bloc of England and the Commonwealth and the United States, Germany, Hitler's Germany, Soviet Russia, the three-power world. They said, Germany we can control because it's boxed in, and all of this is in my book, mm-hmm. it's boxed in between the Atlantic Bloc and the Russians. The Russians will behave because they're boxed in between the Atlantic Bloc, the American Navy and Singapore and so forth, mm-hmm. and the Germans, do you see?
Right.
And therefore, now this is all described in my book, and this was their idea. Now notice, it's a balance of power system. Mm. It's essentially what Kissinger, well, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's bungling everything. Because he's just a prima donna, you know, emotionally unbalanced person. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing, but it was a good idea. And what he should have been doing is described by me, and you really should read this, in Current History for October 1968. Now, if I had a copy, I'd give it to you, but I don't have it. It is how to construct a multi-block world in which the United States would be secure as we ever can be and be independent and have freedom of action. Do you see? But he's blowing it in one way and another. And the whole thing's going to explode in his face, I'm afraid. And I hope to God it doesn't, because we can't afford, you know, another mess like this, these incompetents. Now, what is said in here is that these people are for world domination, and that you and the group I'm talking about were not. Mm-hmm. They were largely, partly financed, for instance, by Rhodes, the Rhodes Trust. And the, how Milner got into this was he was the chief Rhodes trustee mm-hmm. from 1905, when he came back from Africa to his death in 1925. All right. So this was an Atlantic Bloc. Strike. Clarence Strite, S-T-R-E-I-T, Union Now with Great Britain. All right, he represents what this group wanted. Clarence, S-T-R-E-I-T, if he's still alive, he probably lives in Washington. I had his daughter in my class, and as a visitor, but not as a student of mine. And he was built up by this people as the only solution. This is in my book, his name and when it happened. And
by the Round Table people.
By the Round Table people, and it was his book, Union Now, which came out in 1938, was called anonymously in the Round Table magazine by Lionel Curtis, The Only Way it was headed. It was then reviewed anonymously in the Christian Science Monitor by Lord Lothian as the solution of our problems. And what it is essentially a union of the Atlantic Bloc.
Not
world domination. And of course, this was Rhodes' idea.
Right.
He wanted the United States in the English
All right.
Secondly, these people are not pro-communist, as I know them. And certainly the Round Table Group and the Milner Group and the people that I'm writing about, and I notice I followed them up only from 1940, mm-hmm. which is the end of the Morgan Bank, when they had to incorporate because of the inheritance taxes and so forth, they had to incorporate. They were before that a partnership.
When did the Council on Foreign Relations form?
It was originally established by a group here, about 1919,
okay.
But they had in the group that we went is the inquiry. The inquiry was the post-war planning group set up by the Morgan interest in 1917 in the United States, of which the technical head was the head of the American Geographical Society.
Oh, this
is in my book. No, no, no.
Oh, yes,
National Geographic.
I had that on my mind.
It's in my book. You see, my names are slipping me now. Anyway, it's called The Inquiry. There's a whole book on it, and it's called The Inquiry, so you can find it by looking up that title. But you can find it also if you can look at my book. The unfortunate part is it's not in the paperback. It's naturally, it's in the first part when they were forming the thing, which is in the big version of it. The Inquiry got together in Paris and agreed to establish an organization out of which came the Royal Institute of International Affairs. And that Royal Institute of International Affairs had branches in all of the Commonwealth countries, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Canada, eventually in India, and they even, I think, had one somewhere else. Pakistan, when it divided, they established one. But in the United States, of course, they didn't have to because they had the Council on Foreign Relations. But when they came over here, coming back from Paris, they found that a movement had begun here already to form a Council on Foreign Relations, so they moved in and took it over, and they could do that because they represented Morgan. Mm-hmm. And in that crowd was Willard Strait, was a Morgan partner, and he died at the peace conference of the influenza. And, of course, the man who was the active, supposed to be, Lamond, Tom Lamond, great guy for revealing this, but then they became absolutely sour, and they're now denouncing me. I'm a member of the establishment, and
because you're repudiating it?
I don't know.
You don't know
why? I don't know, really. I'm baffled by the whole thing. I don't know why McMillan acted the way it did. I don't know why. I can think these guys are just trying to make a living. I think they'd write anything that they got paid for writing, which is my feeling about it. So, now, I was angry about this. Then somebody wrote to me from the University of Nevada, I believe it was, in Reno, I think. And he was very angry over what was going on there, over this.
Now, this is in the 71?
No, this would be 73.
73, but it came to your attention.
Well, this came in the election of 72.
72.
The
okay.
Spring of 72.
Okay, fine. That was right after it came out.
Yeah, I think.
Okay. And then in 73,
somebody called me. Now, I can give you the exact dates on this if I can get to the papers, but I don't have them anyway. And he wanted me to do something to stop the influence that this book was having in Nevada, particularly as promoting anti-Semitism, because there's a group of people who are using this book, and they're total nuts. I get letters from them all the time. I can show you some of them if you want. Complete nuts. Who claim that this is a Jewish conspiracy, that it's part of the same thing as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which we now know is a Tsarist Russian police forgery of 1905.
It was written by the
This is the same thing
by Madame Blavatsky's disciples.
And the Illuminati were founded in 1776 by a Bavarian named, I think it's Weisskopf.
Weisskopf.
Like and that the Illuminati are a branch of the Masons, and that they took over the Masons, you see. And the whole thing is a nightmare.
Right.
That all secret societies is the same secret society. Now, this was established by nuts for hundreds of years. There were people who set the society of Cincinnati in the American Revolution, of which George Washington was one of the shining lights, was a branch of the Illuminati and was a secret society, and therefore that's why the Masons built the monument in Alexandria to Washington. Not because he was the first president of the United States, because he was the Mason and the head of the Illuminati in this country, and therefore was the one of the founders of the Society of Cincinnati. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes, you can't believe it. Now, these same conspirators are the Jacobins who made the French Revolution. A woman named Nesta, N-E-S-T-A, Webster, wrote that book. To refute it, my tutor, who's a Rhodes Scholar, Crane Brinton, B-R-A-N-T-O-N, wrote his doctoral dissertation called The Jacobins, in which he refutes her. Do you see?
Right.
Now, I think at the end of his life, Brinton probably came to feel that he was wrong, that there was some secret society involved in the Jacobins.
Mm.
And a student of his named Elizabeth Eisenstein, who's a marvelous researcher, she's now a professor at American University, under Brinton wrote a doctoral dissertation on the founder of
the Barbeuf conspiracy. The Barbeuf conspiracy was an conspiracy of the extreme left, which burst out in France in 1894 or so, led by a man named Barbeuf, who was executed for it. But the man behind it was a descendant of Michelangelo named Buonarroti, because Michelangelo's family name was Buonarroti. Look, if you can, at Eisenstein's book, which is published by Harvard, the doctoral dissertation, which shows that Buonarroti founded many secret societies. You see, one of them was the Barbeuf people, who are now being praised to the skies by all the neo-Marxists, like Marcuse and others, you see, as the great heroes, because they tried to change the French Revolution from a middle-class, bourgeois, capitalist revolution, constitutional revolution, into a communist revolution. Now, Buonarroti is also the founder of the Carbonari, of which Mazzini was the head in the 1840s, which united Italy in the 1860s. Do you see? So, as if you start with Buonarroti, which as far as I can see is 1794, I think you can trace a connection down through these various secret societies which culminate in the Mazzini Carbonari. For example, I'll say one thing. Italy was able to get free from Austria because France defeated Austria. Why did France do that? Nobody can see why. It wasn't to France's interest. And yet France declared war in 1859 on Austria, and at the Battle of Magenta and Solferino, defeated, and suddenly made a peace treaty without freeing all of Italy. And the reason we're told they suddenly made the peace treaty without was because the king, the emperor, this is Napoleon III, was so sickened at the sight of the blood. Do you see? Now, why did he do this? He did this because in 1868, a Carbonaro threw a bomb at him. This Carbonaro was arrested, executed, but before he was executed, the emperor went to his cell, as I understand it, and the Carbonaro gave him the secret sign of a fellow Carbonaro, because the emperor of France, who was elected president of France in 1848, seized the throne in 51 and proclaimed a new Napoleonic empire, and was overthrown by the Germans in 71. So he was the emperor for 70, really, for 20 years, you see. But he had been a refugee from France because he tried to make a revolt in France, I think it was 1829. And as a refugee, he joined the Carbonari secret society. Furthermore, he was a private policeman in the Chartist March on Parliament in London in 1848, the year in which he was elected president of France. He's a mysterious figure, do you see? So, what I'm summing up is this. I do think that there is probably a continuous sequence of secret societies from Buonarroti, Barbeuf conspiracy, which is 1894-95, through the Carbonari unification of Italy, which would be 1861. I cannot see anything since then. It may exist. I haven't really studied it. But I cannot see any connection between the Masons and the Illuminati, founded in Bavaria in 1776, and I can't see any connection between them and Buonarroti. Well, now, that's what these people are saying, it's all one.
Right.
And some of them say it goes back to Noah building the ark.
Well, one thing that it seems to me, the conspiracy theory of history is appealing because
It's so simple.
It explains everything that is unexplainable.
It's going wrong.
And if you raise one point that doesn't fit, they say, ah, see how clever the conspiracy is.
Yes. Now,
I want to show you something.
This is what they start. They start by showing you a $1 bill. Mm-hmm. And they say, why is there a pyramid with an eye over it? Do you see?
Mm-hmm.
This is the symbol of the secret society. Now, if you ask people...
any secret society. According to them, there's only one, you see.
That's right. Now, the secret society is the song of generations. Through
yes, yes. Now, if you ask the United States government why it is there, they have great difficulty explaining, and they mostly come up with it's the Masons' Masonic symbol. But then you say, why should the Masonic symbol be on the American dollar bill? And they have no explanation. So there is something. If you look at this monument in Alexandria to Washington, it is the pyramid. Mm-hmm. You see, now there's no, the eye over it is the light. Mm-hmm. You see. Mm-hmm. So I could go further into this, but won't have to, because this symbol is at least 6,000 years old. And I can give you the history of the 4,000 B.C. It has nothing to do with the Masons. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe the Masons adopted it, you see. Mm-hmm. But it has nothing, but I will not go into that. That's a totally different story.
Okay, so this man from Nevada, or this person from Nevada called
me up and said they were having a hard time with the anti-Semites using this book as an argument against Wall Street, against bankers, against Jews, against communists, and everything else. And they wanted me to debate with this fellow who got in touch with me, who was a professor at the university.
To believe, sir.
No, he doesn't believe it. He was trying to get rid of it. The same way the fellow who called me from Brigham Young was trying to stop this hysteria which was sweeping that mountain area, apparently.
Right.
And so they said, would you debate Gary Allen and Larry Abram? And I said, well, I'd rather not, frankly. He said, well, we need your help. And I says, well, are they both going to be debating me? And he says, no, there's a Dr. So-and-so here who will debate with you. And he is, I think, a medical doctor. I'm not certain of that. But he was Jewish. And what he was interested in was the anti-Semitism part of
it. He's going to debate on your team, on your side.
On my side. Right. And they said, it's going to be absolutely the strictest thing. We'll be on the air for an hour. We'll be hooked up on telephone through the country. I will be the coordinator, said this fellow, of this, and it'll be rigorous. You must stay on the subject, or I will stop you. There must be no personality attacks, or I will stop you. You can each talk for 10 minutes, I think it is, or 5 minutes it could have been. And then, when each of the four has talked, I think it was for 10 minutes, then each will have the right to have a 5-minute rebuttal or something, you see. Mm-hmm. Now, in the course of it, I soon discovered that Gary Allen didn't know up from down. But Larry Abram was immensely well-informed. He knew all about corporation finance and bankers and who were their partners. He knew he's tremendous.
How did you find out talking to people?
I found out from the debate.
Oh, okay, that's what I was going to ask. You did go to the debate?
Yeah, Larry Allen simply repeated everything that was in here.
Right.
When I put in my rebuttal and said these various things, he then started pulling information at me, some of it I had never heard of. Now, I don't know everything. And the new book that's out now, published by the Buckley, I guess it's the Bill Buckley Press, Arlington House, I suppose it's Bill Buckley, I'm not sure of that, called The Bolsheviks and Wall Street. Oh, we got to go to lunch. The Bolsheviks in Wall Street has lots of things in there that I didn't know. Mm-hmm. Now you can stop this.
You know the difference between the good and the evil in this world? The caring and the selfish, the Mel Gibson circa Lethal Weapon and the Mel Gibson circa Apocalypto? The difference is that bad people have plans. They always have a fucking plan. Good people don't have plans or missions or agendas. They just stumble through life, thinking we'll all treat each other right if given the chance. Evil people have dry erase boards and PowerPoint presentations and iPad apps to keep track of just how the evil's coming along, whether it needs a course correction, because this quarter's evil is 3.5% lower than last quarter's. Good people don't have PowerPoints. Good people have donuts and word jumbles. For example, the billionaire Koch brothers funded a politician, Scott Walker, to become governor of Wisconsin. They knew that when he became governor, he would fake a budget crisis and he would act like it was the biggest budget crisis to ever hit the planet Earth. He would then pass a law that would destroy collective bargaining, the linchpin for unions. Hidden in that same law would be a provision that allows the Koch brothers to buy state owned utilities for almost nothing with no oversight. Both these things would make insane amounts of money for the Koch brothers. And on top of that, without union donations, very few Democrats would be able to get elected against the billions in corporate donations going to Republicans. With mostly Republicans winning elections, the Koch brothers would be able to purchase more and more of America. Now that's what I call a fucking plan. So that's what the evil people were thinking. During all this time, what were the non-evil people thinking? Man, do I like ravioli. Especially in cream sauce. If I work an extra hour at the shop, I bet I could buy 2 cans of ravioli instead of just the uno. That's what they were thinking. Bad people have plans. We don't have plans. I don't have a plan. You don't have a plan. Your plan was I'm going to watch internet videos. Meanwhile, Halliburton's plan was to cause a military coup in the sovereign country of Eritrea, a place neither you nor I ever knew existed. But they know, because they also have maps. They have dry erase boards and f***ing maps. I'm just saying the good people on this planet are never going to get the upper hand until we get some f***ing office supplies up in here. I'm Lee Camp, and that's your moment of clarity. Get more of these at leecamp.net.